Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Fire up the time machine. We're going to take a trip back in American history to the 19th century and the rise of the American cavalry. Father and son authors Will and John Gorenfeld join me to talk about their new book, Kearney's Dragoons Out West, The Birth of the U.S. Cavalry. It's a fascinating look with many anecdotes based on deep research that they've done over the last few years. And it fills in important historical gaps between, say, the War of 1812 and the Civil War. This podcast is made possible by people like Arlene Montemarano, David Radcliffe, and as I turn the page, Ray Lutz and Jane Williams. They're all subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast, setting an example for you. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and in minutes, you can be equipped with a subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, authors Will Gorenfeld and John Gorenfeld, pair of feasts, are going to take us back in time to the 19th century when cavalry was called dragoons.
I'm back in the saddle again, out where a friend is a friend, where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum wheat. Back in the saddle again.
That's my favorite cowboy crooner, Gene Autry, back in the saddle again. And mounted soldiers, we call them cavalry, but the name cavalry was not adopted, and you explain this late in the book, until pretty close to the Civil War, when right. The first dragoons were renamed the first cavalry. Will Gorenfeld, welcome to the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Glad to be here.
Lean into that microphone.
All right.
There are people all over the world hanging on every word.
All right.
And your son, John Gorenfeld, joins us from London via Skype today. John, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
And let me explain that I've known John Gorenfeld since he published a book about Reverend Moon. It was called The King of America back around 2006 or so. And yeah. John has done many different things as a journalist. And for over 7 years now, he has served as the webmaster of the Peter B. Collins podcast. And we wouldn't be here without you, John, so thank you very much.
Glad to be of service.
Well, there are people who listen to the podcast every day. We are told by Google that we're downloaded in 70 countries, and so I share the credit for that with you. And Will Gorenfeld, you're a retired attorney. You work for Legal Aid, the Court of Appeals here in California. And tell me about how you became interested in the history of the West in the 19th century, and in particular, Kearney's Dragoons. Your book is called Kearney's Dragoons Out West, The Birth of the U.S. Cavalry.
I think probably if I had to really search my soul, it was Cheerios that got me introduced to Western history.
Cheerios?
About 1952, on the back of a Cheerios cereal box, there was cutouts of the Old West, and you could, you know, make a cardboard cutout of Billy the Kid or General Custer and put them on your table and dance them around. And I didn't know who any of these people were. And as a child, I started. There was a wonderful series of books about that time published by Random House called Landmark publications. They dealt in American history, so you could pick out a book on Billy the Kid or Wild Bill Hickok or General Custer or whoever. And they were written at about a sixth grade level, and they were perfect for children to learn to read.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably began my interest.
Cheerios were the gateway drug. I never would have suspected.
Exactly.
And John, do you share your dad's fascination with this history, or is this more of a labor of love inside the family?
Maybe a bit of both. Definitely grew up with The Searchers on heavy rotation in the living room, and it was the West was always a part of the Gorenfeld home.
And I
just remember being dressed up as a cavalry officer, I think, in the third grade or fourth grade. I think I was a one-armed Civil War general for Halloween.
And were there ever horses in the Gorenfeld estate?
Not really. I spent a summer riding a horse for the Forest Service very poorly and hauling mules into the backcountry, but really didn't have a lot of association with horses.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, I read your book and I learned so much because I think, like many Americans, I discovered a huge gap in my knowledge of history. I've studied the Revolution, the founding of the country, up through the War of 1812, and then I don't know if it was a failure on my part to pay attention or it just wasn't stressed in my elementary school and high school history. But that period between 1812 and the Civil War is just kind of westward ho and, you know, some trouble with the Native Americans. But most people really don't have an appreciation for the way the Dragoons first helped explore the West, I guess on the heels of Lewis and Clark, and to map it. And then they patrolled some of the trails that were developed for westward migrants and helped protect some of the wagon trains from interference or attacks by the Indians. And, Will, where did you find all of the information? Because the book reads like you were there. And it is so rich with anecdotes, with names and descriptions of key people and where they came from. Right down to, you know, many of the foot soldiers in a given unit. So talk a little bit about where you got all the information to populate this very interesting book.
Probably if I had to name or blame a source, it would be the computer.
Yeah.
I mean, as digitized information became more and more available after about 2005, the computer became an amazing tool to search for sources.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would direct me to a obscure library in Minnesota, in Indiana, and like the Indiana Historical Society, just to pick on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you find that they have archives of writings of various soldiers that lived in these little towns that spotted the eastern coast. And you start contacting these libraries. They very graciously, for a fee, will Xerox letters and reports that they have in their collection, and you start reading. And one thing leads to another. Then there's the National Archives, which is just a gold mine of information, they're very helpful in digging out microfilms of mm-hmm. old Army reports, and for once again a fee, sending them to you.
Does the Smithsonian's Native American Museum have a research component? Do they collect information there, or is it more of just a display?
I'll turn that over to John. He interned there.
Oh, okay.
I'll turn that back over to you. I really don't know. It's an interesting question, though.
I think that my experience with the Smithsonian is it's mostly artifacts of, mm-hmm. of people. They don't have the records. The Library of Congress and the National Archives are kind of the repositories. When John was at the Smithsonian, there he had to catalog millions of uniforms in their basement. They're awash with artifacts, but I don't think they.
Yeah, at one point I remember wheeling out. We had a photograph. A uniform belonging to these guys called the Zouaves, where it was really trendy during the Civil War to try to look like you were a sort of Moroccan, right? Was that sort of? It was just sort
Correct.
Of like garish. Yeah.
Okay, now I'm learning something new about John here. When did you work at the Smithsonian?
Oh, very briefly in college.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for a summer.
Paid internships.
But it must have given you skills to use in organizing all the data that you collected about the Dragoons during this period, roughly 1834 to 1850. I mean, yeah, that's a massive undertaking, isn't it? I can imagine, you know, just piles of paper, and maybe you organize it by geography or by timeline. But that's quite a task.
Well, fortunately, the Dragoons only consisted of 700 men at their maximum strength. So it wasn't a giant army. We were dealing with about nine companies of soldiers of about 60 men in each company.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be kind of difficult to keep track of where, you know, because often I would find myself thinking, I've read a report somewhere or another. Where did I file that? Yes. And it's often had to write the source and say, send me another copy. But I've got file cabinets full of information.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that we learned was that it's so different to reconstruct things from that are off the beaten path. And then you have to go to, you know, just incredibly obscure army records, as opposed to something like, you know, you're writing about Custer or Billy the Kid, and you know, people have had hundreds of chances to refine the story and to refine our understanding of it. And we were really going into uncharted territory in a lot of ways.
And I read one review online that suggested that this is fairly unique, that you have provided a snapshot of a group of people and a period of time that isn't generally chronicled as effectively anyway elsewhere. Is that fair to say, Will?
Yeah, most of the writings occurred in two places. One was right after the regiment was founded. There were a number of books that were written contemporaneously at that time. And then in the 1920s and 30s, there were a group of historians, mainly in Oklahoma and Indiana, that somehow they found a lot of writings and correspondence of soldiers, and they published some stuff in academic journals.
Mm-hmm.
There was one book written in the 1920s, but not much has been written.
Now, John, you're the guy with the journalism skills here, and one of the things that I noted is frequent references to a soldier who was assigned as a journalist or kind of a clerk who kept records of where a Dragoon's unit was, you know, where they spent the night and what the quartermaster fed them and all those kinds of details. So talk a little bit about the role of these journalists, military journalists, and how did you access their writings and reports?
I should probably turn that part over to my dad. So I was, my journalism background mostly entered into just sort of tuning up the story and trying to find the best human interest angle, as we feature writers
mm-hmm.
were always taught to do.
All right. So
like this guy that wanted to, you know, there was a guy that wanted to move to London and hang out with Charles Dickens and be a writer, but instead he joins the Dragoons and becomes this, you know, genocidal maniac general. And I just tried to pull out interesting things like that from the mm-hmm. records.
So we'll talk a little bit about these journalists, because they kept fairly copious accounts, didn't they?
Variously. You know, if you go back to the 19th century, personal journals like diaries were very common. And mm-hmm. so you would find better educated soldiers just keeping a journal for their family's use or their own personal curiosity, and these pop up all over the place, and some of them get widely covered, particularly during the Civil War. I mean, every literate soldier seemed to keep a pack of letters or a journal. So, but the ones that occurred beforehand are harder to find,
mm-hmm.
and we were fortunate to find a number of them. In fact, I've got a second book now, manuscript that's being reviewed, where I have journals by an Irishman, a Bavarian, and a son of the governor of South Carolina, who all kept a lot of writings, and none of these have been published.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a view of firsthand view of California during the gold rush by these individuals who were out here with the army. So they weren't really journalists so much. Some of the volunteer units in the Mexican War, particularly from Missouri, there was a journalist by the name of Ferguson who wrote quite a bit about his experiences, and there was another one that from the New Orleans Picayune. I can't think of his name right now, but you'd have real journalists, but these are amateurs.
Mm-hmm. And they wrote this in longhand on parchment. Was that converted to microfiche at some point? Microfilm?
Well, some yes and some no. The two that I found, they were just scrawled.
Mm-hmm.
And I acquired, for example, the Bavarian's Journal. That was written after his service, and probably wrote it for his grandchildren. It's just written in a very plain book, with the pages falling out. And now it's in the Yale Library, and it's been microfilmed. But before that, no, it was floating around in somebody's attic.
Now Stephen Kearney is a figure who you follow, and he earns a reference in the title, Kearney's Dragoons Out West. And he was one of the early recruits into the Dragoons. And he rose to the level of Brigadier General in the end. Am I right?
Right.
And so you really follow his ascent and his various adventures leading Dragoons on different missions in the West. Give our listeners a thumbnail sketch of Stephen Kearney. What kind of a character was he? And why was he so driven to lead cavalry units?
Well, he came out of a very wealthy New York family, and he became an officer during the War of 1812. Never went to West Point. Just that they needed officers, and New York was being invaded. So out he went and got captured by the British almost immediately. But he had a curiosity about the West, and he, very early on, the Army marched into places like Indiana and Illinois, and he accompanied the Army as a junior lieutenant officer and kind of fell in love with the West, and that just kind of spurred him to climb the next hill.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army was paying him to do this, so why not?
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting a lot of glory and satisfaction out of what he did, so... He was a very rigid kind of bit of a snot. But on the other hand, I have reports from enlisted men that encountered him off duty, and they found him very humane. So,
mm-hmm. You describe a number of his interactions with Indian tribes and what you describe as the constabulary role of the Dragoons trying to protect white settlers and migrants moving through on these different trails in the West. And in several cases, he had a kind of good cop, bad cop approach,
mm-hmm.
where he'd kind of scare the shit out of them by firing cannons and showing the muscle of the military's munitions, essentially. And at the same time, he seemed pretty compassionate and was in some cases willing to bend the rules of treaty agreements. And let's focus for a minute on the Winnebagoes, because many people know that name from recreational vehicles, but
yeah,
you describe... Go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah, that was definitely the first association that came to mind for me with the Winnebago.
Right. So they were a tribe that was established on the eastern side of the Mississippi River, but in order to make room for white settlers... they were pushed across the Mississippi to lands that were hostile to them. They were hunters, and so farming was not really an attractive option to them. And Kearney really seemed to hear their complaints and say, well, you know, if you sneak back across the river for hunting, it's okay with me. That was kind of the inference that I got.
Yeah, I think if you can talk about Kearney... with the French Métis in Canada, you know, for sneaking across the border, that's even a better example. Here are these illegal immigrants from Canada crossing into what is today, places like Minnesota and Wisconsin, to hunt buffalo, which back then roamed the prairies there, and Kearney, they follow the buffalo across the border. They're technically trespassing, but they're not doing anything really illegal. They've been doing that for 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And
they don't need to recognize the white man's border. Those are just lines on a page.
Right. And Kearney recognized that and told him not to trespass, but he then reported to his superiors, "We can't keep these people out of here. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to fight them." You know, getting back to the Winnebagoes, more of the point was General Sumner. Well, he became a Civil War General Sumner, who was sent to deal with the Winnebagoes after they massacred a white family who had stolen from them. And he could have, you know, gone in there with a cavalry charge a la General Custer and cut down all the men. But no, he decided when he heard how badly they had been treated by the settlers and how they were just in abject poverty, he gave a stern look and appeared to be very forceful. But he did not, aside from imprisoning the killers of these people, two of whom were later paroled. One died in prison. It was kind of the policy that Kearney was kind of his mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And Kearney pretty much impressed on his regiment that you don't use force unnecessarily. And up to 1846, with the Mexican War, you don't see any battles with the Dragoons against the Indians.
Mm-hmm.
It just – now, maybe the things happened and were never reported, but we've been unable to find them.
And before the interview, I had asked you about this because you describe the Dragoons as enforcing the treaty agreements, but you don't have any indication of cases of real screaming abuse where they massacred women and children or wiped out entire encampment of Natives.
Right. For 13 years, they roamed the prairie. They had to deal with some of the most warlike Native peoples on the continent, and there's no report of any battles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the same time, you have the Seminole Wars going on in Florida, which are horrible. They're genocidal. lots of people are dying on both sides, but up north, nothing.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Will Gorenfeld and John Gorenfeld. Their new book is called Kearney's Dragoons Out West. And did he say Kearney, not Kearney? Because we have a street in San Francisco,
right,
and everybody just calls it Kearney.
The pronunciation is Kearney.
Uh-huh.
So
okay.
Take it for what it's worth.
It was spelled all kinds of different ways, though, even in his lifetime, right? The different cities named after
him. Yeah, Kearney, Nebraska is a misspelling. They added an E in there,
mm-hmm,
and that was named after him.
Yeah. And so the other figure that people will recognize the name of is Henry Dodge, and Dodge City and Get Out of Dodge.
Get Out of Dodge, sure.
tell us a little bit about his seminal role in the development of the Dragoons.
He was kind of a protege of Andy Jackson. He was a rough-and-tumble frontiersman that didn't care if an Indian was on his way crossing his land. He'd shoot him. He was not a very nice fellow. He was a dualist, a bit of a crook. Anything else, John, remember about
him?
Yeah,
I mean, just that he was the polar opposite of Stephen Kearney. And so I think we found their clash of personalities really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of proto-Trumpian.
Well, that's kind of interesting.
So in contrast to the, this sort of uptight guy in the sort of more British officer tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's astonishing about Dodge is he kind of precedes Kearney, and he's also very humane when he becomes colonel of the regiment. They're not fighting either. They're trading and dealing, and for the 3 years that he's colonel, there's no battles there either.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of set the mold that Kearney built on. He was not a very effective general. He didn't understand regulations. He probably was semi-literate. There were lots of, trouble getting supplies and uniforms and guns and horses. And organizationally, he was way over his head.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not want to go fight these Indians.
One of the other things that comes up frequently in your depictions of Kearney is that he tried to help the Indians resist the temptations of alcohol And he also was appalled that Americans were selling weapons to the Indians, who then turned them on Americans. So there were a lot of mercenary types operating in the West, and clearly they weren't under the complete control of the military. They were able to, sell booze and weapons to some of the tribes in ways that certainly made the job of the dragoons more difficult.
True. But, the dragoons were fairly effective at keeping alcohol off the reservations, but Indians would travel to trading posts and trade in whatever, supplies they had for booze, mm-hmm. and there was an addiction there, and that was where the problems would occur. Kearney, when he went out west in 1845, was west of the Rocky Mountains. They were manufacturing whiskey in Taos, New Mexico, which was then part of Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and they were shipping it to areas where there were Indians. And Kearney intercepted a wagon train of that stuff and smashed it up. But what I found interesting about him, Kearney later on at the Battle of San Pascual in California in 1846, there's a very strong suspicion in my mind that a lot of the troops were drunk. And Kearney was the commander of these troops and was aware of them. And they were slaughtered by the vaqueros near San Diego, probably partly because they were a little tipsy.
Hmm. And where did they get their fire water?
Well, the ranches and haciendas in California grew wine grapes.
Yeah, you mentioned grape, wine, and that was readily available in Southern California at the time.
Oh, very much so. So they looted.
I thought it started after Prohibition.
No. The Mexicans had a lot of wineries.
It would have started with the Franciscans, who grew grapes for Sacramento wine.
That's true.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then with then you had the Germans and French come in with the Gold Rush, and they built all the wineries in Northern California that flourish today.
And what about whiskey?
Irish.
That was the favorite flavor on the trail, I guess. Where did they get it?
Probably, you're getting off the field, but rot gut whiskey was not very good for human health and was consumed widely in the West and widely available. So,
now, Will and John, one of the things that I was intrigued by is that in various passages in the book, there are references to issues related to the horses. And it's hard to be a dragoon or a mounted soldier if you don't have a good steed. And I kept thinking about this in different passages in the book where, these overland movements were grueling and had to be torture for the animals. And I'm just curious, how serious was the military about raising and training horses specifically for military use? And were the horses that they chose appropriate for the various rugged terrain that they faced in the West?
Well, the horses tended to come out of Missouri and Kentucky. They were big bones, sorrel horses, quarter horses, large creatures. The Indian horses, on the other hand, were much more adaptable to the plains and the scarcity of food. So the first problem a military unit going west had to have was they had to carry their own food for not only the soldiers but the horses.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think about all the mules that were weighted down, it's kind of diminishing resources. Added to that was the as you go into areas that don't have a lot of water, the horses don't do well. So when Kearney comes west to Santa Fe in 1846, by the time he reaches Santa Fe, his horses are pretty well used up.
Mm-hmm.
And when he leaves for California, most of his men are mounted on mules. And during the trip, the 2,000-mile trip to California, they're dropping like flies.
Well, you describe in the first 50 miles, he had to scale way back. He had wagons loaded with supplies.
Right.
He had a couple of howitzers. I guess those were on wheels.
Yep.
Pulled by a couple of mules. but he reduced the size of his contingent and even still suffered huge losses by the time he made it to California.
Correct. And that includes he ended up stealing horses from the Mexicans when he got to California and mules. So, yeah, his horses were just about played out by the time he reached California, if any existed even. So when he gets to the Battle of San Pascual, his men are riding on mules and horse and untrained horses, which added to their drunkenness. So they did not do well.
And would the Indian tribes freely swap horses for in a barter method, or were they very protective about them? And did the military basically have to just grab them?
I don't think they would have been able to grab them without a serious fight. But they did trade horses when Kearney marched west with the Apaches in what is today Arizona. They traded and bartered with the Papagos and the Apaches for horses and food, and got some horses.
And how well trained were the soldiers in terms of taking care of their horses and bonding with them? I mean, if you're in a battle and you're riding a horse, you've got to have confidence that horse will do what you want it to do and not just eject you.
Right. Well, there's an old saying in the cavalry, your best friend is your horse. And it's true. And cavalrymen, dragoons, were taught to take good care of their horses. Some learned and some didn't. Every company of 60 men had a farrier, which is like a veterinarian, to remind them and make sure they took care of their horses. But, you go to the Custer battle, for example, a number of men were spared that battle because their horses broke down on the march. They came up a day late, which was saved their lives, but because they did not care for their horses, they survived. And that was very true of most military movements out west, that horses are very touchy. They don't do well on long marches.
And if you lose your mount, you're out of business.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, one of the interesting things is that they tried camels at one point, didn't they, Dad, at Fort Tejon, which is this fort near Bakersfield off the old I-5, which is where I guess the dragoon interest really started.
Yeah, when
Gorman.
When Jefferson Davis was Secretary of War in the years before the Civil War. He hit on the idea that camels could replace horses, so they started importing camels in the mid-1850s, and they thought about mounting the dragoons on camels, but they never, the experiment never really worked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they tried racing to the scene of the battle on a camel. That didn't really seem like it would be a good
way. Well, it doesn't fit with the Hollywood depiction of the Wild West.
But there was a civilian camel charge near the Colorado River in like 1857 against a band of Indians, but the army never did anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I should have asked this much earlier, but what is the origin of the term dragoon, and why was that converted to the term cavalry by either President Lincoln or someone in his cabinet?
Well, dragoon is kind of, if you go back to the period of the Revolutionary War, it was a form of cavalry. I mean, cavalry included, like lancers were cavalry. You had hussars, which was light cavalry. You had cuirassiers, who was heavy cavalry. So you had different types of cavalry during the Napoleonic era. So dragoons was one version, and what they were was really a mounted unit that had firepower, and they kind of dated back to around the 17th century, where you started putting men on horses who could fire weapons and then get the heck out of there or stop and try to hold a position while the other soldiers came up. So dragoon pistols, which the early dragoons carried, they had a fire-breathing dragon at the barrel, and the decoration on the pistols were of a dragon spitting out fire. And the British mispronounced the French name, and they turned, I don't forget what the French word is, but for dragon, but the mispronunciation was dragoon.
Mm-hmm. Now,
dragon, something like that.
Or maybe dragon, something.
Dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, we think back in the medieval era of horse-mounted fighters, but they were loaded up with armor.
Right.
So when was the trade-off made for speed over defensive security?
Well, you had heavy cavalry, armored cavalry, into the Franco-Prussian War. The French were still running around with their metal breastplates, so it didn't really end until firepower started shooting them out of their saddles. So when they became casualties and not victors, they started looking for other functions of cavalry, which was lighter.
Mm-hmm.
And but even the dragoons, their equipment and saddle would weigh about 80 pounds plus the rider. So it's still not a very lightweight unit.
Yeah.
Unlike the Indians, it just carried a weapon and a human.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a chase, the dragoons were always going to lose.
Yeah.
Against the Native Americans.
All right, I want to call on my old friend Gene Autry for another little ditty here. That's from the album Public Cowboy Number 1. And it's called Mexicali Rose. And I wanted to use that to set up the Mexican War, because this is a fascinating segment of your book, again, that I really knew just sketchy things about. I've been to New Mexico on vacation, and frankly, I never saw any monuments or read anything that explained exactly how New Mexico was acquired by the United States. And, Will, in your book, President James Polk is the driver of this expansionism, and you told me that he actually kept his campaign promise.
Correct.
Which was?
Grab California and New Mexico. New Mexico, because you have to get to California, so you need both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And pick up Texas while you're at it.
And New Mexico and Arizona were actually one unit, right?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
Correct. You know, even before Polk's presidency, the Texas Republic in 1843, they tried to acquire New Mexico as part of Texas, because they claimed it was part of Texas under Mexican rule. So they would send armies to grab New Mexico. So it was always a prize. And the Santa Fe Trail was, of course, established in 1820 or so. It was a very important route for Missourians, because they were getting a lot of trade from northern Mexico back and forth into Santa Fe. So there was always, Santa Fe was kind of a magic city that, and I think a lot of people in the East thought it was also full of gold and silver and all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of temptation there.
Mm-hmm. And you write that at the beginning of, I think it's 1846, correct me if I don't have the site right in front of me, the consensus in Washington was that the U.S. was gearing up for a war against Britain. But instead, things shifted dramatically in the month of May. And what surprises me is the speed with which things shifted, and what was viewed, I suppose, by Polk and his generals in Washington as an opportunity to take on the Mexicans and grab territory. It happened in the space of a few days. This is before the telegraph. How were they able to get information out to the front as these things were changing so quickly? And basically, our posture toward Mexico went from neutral to aggressive.
Well, I think the the Polk administration had eyes on California in 1845, and he sent Zachary Taylor with an army of observation to Galveston. And so they were already sending troops down there a year before the war broke out. At the same time, they had taken on England over 5440, over up the boundary line in Washington. So there was like two wars we were liable to get into simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very, very clumsy diplomacy, to say the least, because that could have well happened. I mean, our relations with England in 1845 were very tense, too. And just the last minute, they resolved the British through British diplomacy. They worked out the boundary of the border, And so they didn't have to send troops up to Washington at the same time, which would have been horrible. What they did do at that time, though, is they reinforced all the forts along the East Coast to keep the British fleet from sailing in and doing battle there. So they felt fairly confident that they could keep the British at bay with the forts and while they were invading Mexico, but it was rather foolish.
Mm-hmm. And Kearney and his dragoons had to lobby Washington to be assigned to the Mexican War. Explain that.
Well, once again, the magic of the Santa Fe Trail, the dragoons were formed, became pretty much interested in protecting that trail, which the Army and the diplomats regarded as vital. So they wanted to keep Kearney and his boys to protect the trail, regardless of what happened with England or Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like isolated. And there were some dragoon companies, I think two companies, that never really got into the war. They were still protecting the trail, mostly from Indians, but they did not go into Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And talk about the manner in which this was resolved.
Well, I mean, they resolved the war with England through diplomacy.
No, I'm referring to Mexico, the surrender.
Okay. Well, there's a section in southern Texas between the Nueces River and the Rio Grande that Mexico claimed jurisdiction over after its war with Texas. It was disputed. There's a legitimate claim by Texas that it was part of Texas. So when Texas became a state, it went down to the Rio Grande. So you had this gray area, and both armies sent troops into the area, allegedly to protect their interests in this part of the map. And a unit of 2nd Dragoons came into contact with Mexican cavalry, was pretty near annihilated by the Mexican cavalry, and that was the, they killed our boys on our soil, and away the war went.
Mm-hmm. And so out of that, the U.S. got Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California?
And Colorado.
And Colorado.
Wow. In the bargain, yep.
Yeah.
Almost a six-pack.
Yeah, it increased the size of the country, probably by at least a third.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was rather, then gold was discovered right after the treaty was signed about 2 weeks later. So it was quite a bargain for Polk.
Mm-hmm. Now, before he died, Kearney, who had risen to the level of brigadier general, insisted on bringing court-martial charges against John Fremont.
Oh, yes.
And Fremont is kind of well-known here in Northern California. There's a city named after him. And he was a bit of an outlier. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Oh, no question. No question. I mean, Fremont invaded California with a military force before the Mexican War. And the Mexicans threw him out, justifiably.
Was he given orders by Polk to do that?
Nobody knows. It's one of those great mysteries of history that the Americans that had been settling in California were talking about revolting, and it appears that Fremont was sent to give them a military backbone, the Bear Flag Republic people that eventually took over the state. But they threw Fremont out of the state. He skedaddled up to Oregon, waiting for the Bear Flag Rebellion to occur, which it did. Then he came right back to protect these honorable citizens, and became. And they were glad to have an officer to lead them, along with the U.S. Navy that suddenly sailed into Monterey, and took Monterey. So, we were waiting for the Bear Flag Rebellion to occur, and I think Fremont was an enabler of that. Now, this got what happened then with Kearney marching from the east with his army, with in hand orders from President Polk to become the military governor of California. He runs into Fremont, and Fremont says he's the military governor. So you have two armies standing off, and Kearney says, "I'm a general. You're just a captain. You must obey me," and Fremont is protesting. Oh, but President Polk has given him authority. Well, Fremont says, "Show me your orders," and he doesn't have any.
Uh huh.
And that was the court martial.
Interesting. And then you say that in August of 1861, because of bureaucratic efficiency, Abraham Lincoln's War Department changed the names of the Dragoons and Mounted Rifle Regiments to Cavalry to fight the Confederacy. The 1st Dragoons thus disappeared, renamed the 1st Cavalry. So basically, they existed from about 1834 until 1861.
Right, as Dragoons,
mm-hmm.
and they still exist, as the book points out. They're now armored a unit down at Fort Hood, Texas, and so they do still survive.
Yeah. I remember the debate in 2008 when McCain was trying to compare himself to Obama on military issues, and it was in 12. It was against Romney. Where Obama had the well-rehearsed line, well, you know, we don't use the cavalry anymore. because I guess the talking point was that Obama hadn't upgraded our military sufficiently. So I thought that was kind of a funny reference at the time. And John, you dropped me an email before the interview about the debate and controversy underway now about Trump's idea of building a wall along the Mexican border. Yeah. And in particular, Ryan Zinke, who is the newly minted Interior Secretary, is saying, you know, this is difficult. And, you know, we don't want to put the wall on the north side of the Rio Grande because we would then be conceding the river to Mexico. But, of course, trying to put it on the Mexican side of the border and get them to pay for it just seems like almost an invasion.
Yeah, it seems like a blast from the past, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think when we were ginning up the Mexican War, there were businessmen who were saying, we're going to make Mexico give us a bunch of money and we're going to take their land. And, yeah, Ryan Zinke says, we're going to put it on the Mexican side of the Mexican side of the river.
Well, yesterday I did a story. They extended the bidding deadline for companies that want to offer a proposal to build Trump's wall. And one of the – it has to be 18 feet high, 6 feet okay. thick, and it must have a pleasing paint job on the north side.
Oh, I see.
But not on the south.
Okay. So it's going to be this, like, monstrosity on the other side.
Well, I just think it's funny that they want it to look pretty for Americans who are looking at it, but they don't give a shit about how it looks on the other side. I think that's a statement in itself.
I'm kind of amazed that nobody before now has thought about what side of the river to build this thing. I mean, the fact that you can't please anybody, regardless of where you build it.
Well, I think it's ridiculous to try to build along the river.
Well, exactly.
You know, it's
it snakes around.
Yeah, it's a big waste of money, and there are sovereignty and borderline issues. And, of course, you know, this is just another example of the guy who never thinks anything through. It gets applause at one of his rallies, and that's all he needs. So, gentlemen, yeah. I want to thank you for a really interesting dive into this period of time. And I really recommend your book, Kearny's Dragoons Out West, The Birth of the U.S. Cavalry, to our listeners. And it's published by University of Oklahoma Press. Will, where's the best place for people to buy your book?
God knows.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Amazon probably.
I hate to push Amazon, but yeah. I know somebody that bought it at the bookstore in Novato, but they had to order
it. Yeah, I mean, call up Flory's Books in Pacifica and place an order and maybe able to get it.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, we will have to divert people to Amazon unless we find a local mom-and-pop bookstore that we would prefer to support. So thank you for joining me today.
It's been fun.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks for sharing this important history with our listeners. And thanks for listening to this in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Your comments are welcome. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.